Welcome all. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva. We are continuing our study of this essay, Rayonot al HaTfilah, Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay on the Amidah, on the Jewish prayer, translated here as Reflections on the Amidah in this volume, Worship of the Heart, Essays on Jewish Prayer by Rabbi Soloveitchik. I had mentioned last week that I was not certain, and when I looked into it, apparently it is not clearly known exactly when this essay was written. So I don't have an answer, but it's possible that the answer is not hadable. So that's that. Welcome to all of you. I see a few new faces, a few new names. I won't repeat what we started with last week, but suffice to say, on the archives of Web Yeshiva, you can go back and get all the previous sessions on our study of Rabbi Soloveitchik and prayer, or on Rabbi Soloveitchik in general. Let me pick up where we left off after the introduction to this essay, which we started last week. Here you go. The Rav revisited some territory which should be familiar to those of you that have been attending the course the last number of weeks and months. The Rambam, Maimonides' position on the biblical obligation of prayer. The Rambam's position, Maimonides believed that daily prayer is a biblical obligation. Min HaTorah, we're obligated to pray every day. Now, that doesn't mean that the way Jewish prayer is organized today is all of it in and of itself biblical in origin. In other words, if I could take, let me just open up a whiteboard here. There you go. If we imagine that there's some kind of biblical obligation, let's say that this represents the biblical obligation to pray, which, let's say for the sake of argument, according to Maimonides, it means that every day, once a day, doesn't matter when, if you're a morning person, you're a morning person, if you're a night person, you're a night person, but once a day, you're obligated to pray. When you pray, it could be that there's an accompanying obligation that you should face Jerusalem, but that's not so much an obligation of prayer as it is an obligation to show reverence for the site of the temple. You should face Jerusalem, and you should articulate your prayer. And on the biblical level, the prayer might need to contain three elements. What we call in Hebrew, let me just put it up here on the board, Shevach, Bakasha, and Hoda'ah. The three biblical components of prayer: Shevach is praise of God. Bakasha is an articulation of your requests, of your needs. And Hoda'ah is thanksgiving. So that every day you would get up and you would say a little prayer that might go something like this. Oh, great God, give me some food because I'm kind of hungry. Thanks a lot. Not the most articulate prayer ever recited. On the contrary, it might be the very least articulate prayer ever recited. But it would fulfill the biblical obligation to pray. This notion that prayer is a communication with God, to God, where you are enumerating your needs, and that enumeration of needs is somehow sandwiched between these concepts of praise of God and thanking Him for being receptive to our needs. Miriam says that this is the obligation, the minimum obligation that's required of women. Not exactly. Without going into it now, although I understand that Rabbi Fink is dealing with this in some of his classes this semester in Rabbi Shiva, without going into the practical halachot of women's obligation in prayer, even on a rabbinic level, women are obligated to do more than just this main thing. But everybody, from the Torah perspective, this is all that was required, according to the Rambam. Then along came Chazal, along came the rabbis of the Talmud, and they superimposed around the biblical obligation all types of rabbinic obligations. That includes three times a day, and that includes this whole notion of minyan, that the very significant preference to pray in a community with at least 10 people. This includes, this includes, again, three times a day, a set text, set times. These are the rabbinic obligations that are superimposed. When we pray from the Siddur, from the Jewish prayer book, we are praying the rabbi's prayer. But every rabbinic prayer contains within it this kernel of biblical prayer. I'm not going to rehearse this anymore. This is a topic that we've discussed numerous times in the past. But I'm just summarizing for you again the Rambam's position. Okay. The Ramban, however, and the Rav spoke with great passion about how the Rambam redeemed Jewish prayer, redeemed it in the sense that the Rambam put prayer front and center as a topic of a Jewish philosophical investigation. The Ramban, Nachmanides, in trying to defend those of Rambam's predecessors who did not regard prayer as a biblical commandment, found it necessary to admit that, despite the absence of fixed law obligating daily prayer, the substance of prayer and its essence are derived from the Torah. The Ramban disagreed. The Rambam felt that, biblically speaking, min haTorah, there's this daily obligation to pray in this kind of unstructured, free form. As long as you hit these three notes, that's prayer. The Ramban disagreed. The Ramban thought that there is no such obligation to pray, that there is no such obligation to pray daily, that what we do when we pray the regular daily services is fully rabbinic in nature. Here, by I say rabbinic in nature, I'm talking about the Amidah. Again, when we talk about prayer, we're talking about the Amidah. We're not talking about Shema. According to everyone, the recitation of Shema is biblical. Here, we're talking about the obligation to pray the Amidah, the Shemona Esrei, the standing silent worship. When we pray, we do all types of other things. Our prayer also constitutes a kind of formalized Torah study, certainly reading of the Torah. Everybody understands that Torah study is a biblical obligation. But I'm talking about the obligation of prayer as prayer, which is carried out through the Shemona Esrei. Even though when we go to shul, or even though when we open a siddur, we're doing all types of other things as well. The Ramban, however, did agree there is a biblical obligation to pray, but not daily. There's a biblical obligation to pray be'et tzara, at times of trouble, perhaps national trouble, perhaps times of war, perhaps times of strife. Anyone else not the rabbi in the primary video window? Oh, I see. The active speaker. Okay, here we go. That should work. Hello? There I am. Okay, I'm sorry, did I fix the video? So even the Ramban, even Nachmanides, who disagrees with the Rambam and does not accept the idea of an obligatory daily prayer from the Torah, admits that there is a biblical concept of prayer, but only in times of distress. Despite the absence of fixed law obligating to prayer, the substance of prayer and its essence are derived from the Torah. In times of distress, he admitted, there exists a biblical obligation upon the community to cry out and beseech the God of Israel. In effect, Ramban's concession mitigates his absolute position that prayer is not a biblical obligation at all. But even the Ramban admits that there are times of biblical obligation to pray, but not on a daily basis. Actually, it was already the Rambam, Maimonides, who also introduced the idea of seeing the importance of prayer in times of trouble and distress. That's the obligation to blow on the trumpets, the chatzotzrot, and to plead and to cry out. So even the Rambam admits, this is in Hilchot Ta'aniyot, in the laws of fasts, the very first halakha in the Rambam's laws of fasting says, mitzvat asei min ha-Torah, lizok ulehariya b'chatzotzrot al kol tzara shetavo al ha-tzibur. There's a separate obligation to call out, to cry out, to blow on the trumpets, which were a kind of sign of trouble, leharia, like we have on the shofar, the blowing of the shofar. They would blow on the chatzotzrot, on these trumpets at times of particular trouble as a call to fast. We're not here talking about our fast days, the set calendar fast days that correspond to particular events in Jewish history, particular tragedies in Jewish history, but that they would institute fasts at need during times of distress or times of trouble. The Rambam admits to the Ramban that there is an obligation to do that, but the Ram counts that separately from the daily obligation, the garden variety obligation of prayer. According to the Rambam, it's impossible to conceive of divine worship without including prayer in it. So here's the kernel of the debate between Maimonides and Nachmanides. The Torah talks about a notion of avodah shebelev, service of the heart. The question is, what is that service of the heart? How do we worship? So the Rambam says it's inconceivable that the Torah would posit that there is a type of service or worship of God with the heart, and it wouldn't be prayer. In other words, we're not talking about the daily rabbinic obligation to pray. But if we peel away, I'm sorry, I've muted everyone. If somebody wants to speak on the microphone, I'm delighted that you should do so. Just please, raise your hand, or only unmute yourself if you have something to say, otherwise it creates some static. Jack, did you want to say something?
No.
Okay, so I'm muting you again. But this question of if we could peel back the rabbinic layer and shave away the rabbinic obligations superimposed on the notion of prayer and recover that the biblical kernel, what would it look like? So the Rambam, the Rav says that the Rambam says it's inconceivable that there wouldn't be a daily obligation to pray. And that has something to do with the question of what then is prayer. If we understand what prayer is in the Maimonidean worldview, then it will be apparent why it had to be a daily obligation. Prayer is the expression of the soul that yearns for God via the medium of the word, through which the human being gives expression to the storminess of his soul and spirit. That's the kind of thing, in a college textbook, we would have put the yellow highlight on. It's a profound definition of Jewish prayer. Again, it's Rabbi Soloveitchik's formulation of what he understood the Rambam's position to be. That prayer is the expression of the soul that yearns for God via the medium of the word. So that this reminds us of something that we saw a few weeks ago in Rav Kook, Rav Kook's notion of the soul always being in communion with God. And the metaphor that I used to understand what Rav Kook was saying was like the old kinds of stoves that had a pilot light. The pilot light was always lit, but when you wanted to boil a kettle of water, you would call up the little flame that rested inside the stove up to the burner, and then when you were done, you would turn off the burner and the flame would once again be reduced to the inside. But that notion that the soul is always in this kind of type of communication, and sometimes it's brought to the forefront and sometimes not. When I remember when I was in college, I had a college roommate my last year of college who was he got engaged to the woman he's still married to at the end of college, and they would, you know, in those days everybody, you know, there were no cell phones, of course, so everybody in the dorm would share one landline, and he'd be on the phone all night with his fiancée, and, you know, he'd be like under the covers talking to her, and they would fall asleep while still on the phone, and in the morning, like, the phone would be like off the hook, like, you know, strewn across the dorm room floor, and I would hear her, like, on the other end. She had woken up, and she's calling his name in the phone, trying to see if he's still there. But, you know, while they weren't talking for however many hours they were asleep, the line was still open. So that's the kind of notion that Rav Kook puts forth, which is similar to what we're putting here. The notion that's the soul. The soul is yearns for God, and it does so via the medium of the word. That the spoken word. Let me just look at these chats. Yeah, so Peter asks the question, is prayer always considered audible on our level as spoken in words? Yes, according to the halakha, Jewish prayer is not one of internal meditation. It has to be articulated words. And as a matter of fact, preferably while recited silently, but recited silently in a whisper. It's not enough to just, certainly not merely to think the words, but actually to articulate the words, to actually form the words with your mouth, although to do so silently, even if you're praying alone. And if you're praying in the congregation, so one should not pray out loud in such a way. Again, we're talking about not the kind of communal prayers, but the silent worship, the Amidah, should be recited in a very, very, very low undertone to oneself, so that it shouldn't be audible to other people, so either so as not to disturb them or so as to emphasize the kind of individual private nature of the prayer, even though in reality we're all more or less saying the same words. But this notion that prayer is that, yeah, I mean, again, there seems to be some confusion on this. When I say prayer, I'm talking about the Amidah. Let's leave that as a caveat throughout all of our conversations. I'm talking about the Amidah, the Shmona Esrei. So this idea that the yearning of the soul has to be expressed through words. Now, this is a very profound notion. Perhaps a particularly Jewish notion that words are somehow the hallmark of who we are. Language is somehow the hallmark of who we are as engaged, thinking, religious beings. Recall Rashi's comment at the beginning of Bereshit, that part of what makes us, part of what actually is a reflection of our Tzelem Elohim, being created in God's divine image is the ruach with which we are filled, the ruach, the spirit with which God endowed us, is ruach memalala, is that we are a speaking entity, a speaking spiritual entity, and that the communication between us and the divine has to be articulated in and through language. And it's through that language which the human being gives expression to the storminess of his soul and spirit. The Torah commands love and fear of God. Right? If this was high school and we were studying this, and you would suspect that there might be a quiz, so you should, you know, you would think, ah, this is something that might be asked on a quiz. What is Rabbi Soloveitchik's conception of prayer? What is Rabbi Soloveitchik's conception of Maimon? What is Rabbi Soloveitchik's understanding of the Rambam's conception of prayer? And the correct answer would be right here. The Torah commands love and fear of God, total commitment to Him and cleaving unto Him, antithetical, dynamic experiences which seek to erupt and reveal themselves must be integrated into the external concrete realm through the forms of language and expression by means of song, weeping, and supplication. This is, again, going back to something we've discussed numerous times, and we talked about again last week, the tension between objective and subjective, between fluid and normative, between internal and concretized external. That may be part of the reason that the halakha prefers articulated prayer. That you actually have to say it. You actually have to articulate something. If we were to, it's hard enough to generate the kind of kavana, intent, in prayer when there is a set text. But if we were to tell everyone, think your prayer, well, we'd really be floating off into the clouds, unrooted by anything, and the challenge, you know, possibly might be too great. Sybil asks a question about which language to pray in. The halakha is pretty clear that it's preferable to pray in Hebrew, the Hebrew of the set text of the prayer. But the halakha is also clear that in the inability to do that, prayer can be recited in any language as long as you understand it. But even if your understanding of Hebrew is very limited and imperfect at best, praying in Hebrew, if possible, is always preferable. That may have something to do with the inherent sanctity of the language, although there are debates about what the source of the sanctity of the language is, but it may also have something to do with the unifying nature of prayer. Now, this the Rambam discusses at the beginning of Hilchot Tefillah, the Laws of Prayer, and this we did look at in some depth a number of weeks ago. The Rambam gives the kind of history of Jewish prayer, and he mentions that, well, once upon a time, of course, Hebrew was the lingua franca. Hebrew was the daily spoken language of the Jewish people. But once we went out into exile, that was no longer the case, and Hebrew became relegated to ritual use, and everybody spoke whatever the language of their host culture was. We invented Judaized versions of the languages of the host cultures, to wit, Ladino, to wit, Judeo-Arabic, to wit, of course, most famously, Yiddish, but not Hebrew, certainly not pure Hebrew of any sort or of any period. And the idea that, nevertheless, Jews around the world prayed in Hebrew, that the Jew from Morocco and the Jew from Warsaw and the Jew from New York or London could all meet, you know, on some neutral territory and would have a common language to share, and that the prayer was recited in the common language of the dispersed but unified Jewish people. That may also be one of the values that are motivating that. Hillel Halkin, you know, who's a pretty well accomplished translator of Hebrew literature, contemporary Hebrew literature. He's a writer and other things. He has a line in an essay where he's actually bemoaning the sad state of Hebrew in the Jewish world today, where he says that for 2,000 years of the diaspora, Hebrew was not the first language of any Jew, but it was the second language of every Jew. And it was the secret handshake that that united us. Agnon has a line someplace where he's quoting someone else. He says that just like what happened to Talis and Tefillin, once upon a time Talis and Tefillin were worn all day. The times of the Talmud, people would wear their tallit, and the tefillin was part of the daily garb. And then at a certain point, Talis and Tefillin were relegated to the synagogue, even though prior to that it was part of the daily wardrobe. So too Hebrew. Hebrew was once the language of scholarship, but it was also the language of the shuk. It was also the language of the marketplace. It was also the language of the street. But when we went into exile, Hebrew became the language of the synagogue. Now, Sherry points out that this may have been more true for Jewish males than for Jewish females. At different periods, it was also true for Jewish women. But even most unlearned Jewish women, or women who were learned in according to the standards of what education was for women, knew the rudimentary prayers in Hebrew. A woman was able to daven in Hebrew, even if she had a sitter that had the Yiddish teich, that had Yiddish translation. But we digress. Had the Torah not commanded prayer as the exclusive medium for expressing inward worship, we do not know. We do not know what the God-seeking human being whose soul thirsts for the living God would do. This is like, it's inconceivable. It's inconceivable that the Torah wouldn't have obligated prayer. Because like, if you could imagine a parallel universe in which we exist without prayer, the soul would self-destruct, it would explode, because it needs to have that release. If God had not invented the mechanism of prayer, what would have happened to us? And you can imagine a parallel universe in which there's the Torah and there's the Halakha, but there's this detail or there's that detail. You know, you can imagine a world in which shatnez is not forbidden. But it's impossible to imagine a religious life without prayer. And therefore it's not surprising that, and we don't come to do comparative religion, it's not surprising that all religions in one form or another do have some notion of prayer, even though they will differ very widely in the scope and the nature and the makeup and the content and the focus and etc. But the notion of prayer seems to be a universal component of religious life in general. Could one entertain the thought that Judaism would want man to suppress his experience? On the contrary, the halakha was always interested in expressions of the inner life, in the uncovering of the subjective and opaque, and in the conversion of emotion and thought into action. Again, this is the theme we talked about at such length yesterday, and last week and in the past. That prayer itself is the mechanism by which we externalize the fluid, liquid, subjective inner components. How could one assume that the halakha was totally oblivious to the supreme attainment, that is, to prayer? Did halakha demand that worship be mute, that experiences be concealed, that they not be allowed expression? When the Rambam said that prayer is biblically ordained, that there's a biblical obligation, a mitzvah min ha-Torah, to pray daily, and identical with the service of the heart, when he accepts the notion that avodah shebelev, worship of the heart, is by definition prayer, he thereby redeemed love, fear, and indeed our entire religious life from muteness. But without prayer, religious life would be stifled. It would be stymied. It would be muted. They were given a voice. The lover expresses his yearning. The trembler, his fear. The wretched and dejected, his helplessness. The perplexed, his confusion. And the joyful, his religious song. All within the framework of prayer. I'll just mention, again, put in the caveat now and let it apply to all of our conversations. I'll mention again what I've said before. All of these essays were written in a period before our contemporary sensitivities to gender-neutral language. When the Rav talks about he and him and his, it's not meant for the exclusion of she and hers. She and hers and women and everything in this conversation about prayer is equally relevant to men as it is to women, even though, as Miriam pointed out, halakha l'maaseh, there are certain differences between a man's obligation to pray and a woman's obligation to pray, but that's on the rabbinic level. On a biblical level, women are equally obligated to pray the same as men, at least according to the Rambam. The Rav Sherry asks again. This essay was originally written and published in Hebrew. It was written by the Rav in Hebrew, although again I don't know, or it's not known. Exactly when it was written. Dominic is writing, is the value of a sung prayer higher than a recited one? No, I'm not sure. I don't think so. It's true. Dominic, you referenced these psukim from Tehillim, these verses from Psalm that talk about singing, and in reality, much of our worship is, certainly our communal worship is tied to song and singing, but not certainly not in the context of the Amidah. The Amidah is recited, maybe recited with that kind of sing-song repetition, but it's more of in the Rav's phrase in other essays, a colloquy. This is talking about the Amidah, the silent worship. The service of the heart gained a foothold in the world of forms and facts. Experience and prayer constitute two poles between which the great service of God oscillates. And here, again, I won't go into this in detail because we did talk about it at such length in the last series, but he summarizes here the topic of ma'aseh and kiyum, of the mitzvah act versus the fulfillment of the mitzvah, which are not simultaneous, which are not synonymous, although they're obviously related. That one can perform the, quite literally, the lip service, one can perform the mitzvah act without fulfilling the inner obligation. And again, this deals with the connection between these two dyads, these two different poles of inner and outer, of subjective and objective, etc. If this is not familiar to you, I suggest you go back into the archives and visit some of the conversations that we had a number of weeks ago. I'm going to skip this next paragraph, which which revisits that whole topic, and of course with reference to Reb Chaim, where we started off last semester. Hasidut, Hasidism, the spiritual movement begun in Eastern Europe in the 18th century, which was a type of corrective on certain excesses in Jewish life. Hasidut, which placed so much stress on the spiritual element, the subjective, stress on the subjective in religious life, and which devoted so much attention to the act of prayer and to the individual coming closer to God through prayer, is also sustained by Rambam's view of Avodah Shebalev as an all-encompassing, all-penetrating experience. Because of Rambam, the concept of prayer became a central element in Jewish thought. In other words, this is like an anachronism. The Rambam lived in the 12th century. Hasidut was begun in the second half of the 18th century. But he says that even Hasidut, you know, the Rambam, he was not a chosid. I mean, he was a chasid, but he wasn't a chosid in the contemporary parlance of Hasidut. But, you know, even Hasidut finds justification in the Rambam's redeemed vision of prayer. Prayer, which is like a mirror reflecting the image of the person who worships God with heart and soul, is shot through with perplexity. For worship itself is rooted in the human dialectical consciousness. Hence, prayer is not marked by monotonous uniformity. It is multicolored. It contains contradictory themes, expresses a variety of moods, conflicting experiences, desires oscillating in opposing directions. So this is, since this is the case, since the set text of the prayer, and again, to be clear, the set text of the prayer is rabbinic in force, but the rabbis of the Talmud, of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, when they set the fixed text, the fixed formula for prayer, it was meant to be a reflection of this stormy inner soul questing to colloquy, to dialogue with the divine. And therefore, the text has to, it can't be a kind of flat, straightforward, linear expression of, oh great God, give us our needs, thank you very much. And all of the richness and the complexity of the themes, all of the richness and the complexity of the soul, the questing, yearning soul, has to be reflected in the text. And that's what he's going to do in the essay. He's going to show how the Amidah itself is a reflection of these very fluid, subjective, complex components and themes of the questing soul. Religious experience is multi-directional movement, metaphysically infused. Therefore, prayer too does not proceed slowly along one straight path, but leaps and cascades from wondrous heights to terrifying depths and back. And now he says in the second part of the essay, we have to examine the fundamental components of the Amidah. And here we can dispatch this with a certain amount of you can move through it with a certain amount of speed because these are familiar ideas. He reminds us of the Rambam in Hilchot Tefillah, at the beginning of Hilchot Tefillah, what I've already reviewed for you, the notion that prayer itself on a biblical level contains the three components, Shevach, Bakasha, and Hoda'ah, praising God, an articulation of our requests, and thanking him. Needless to say, the Rambam derives his position from Talmudic sources. He doesn't invent this idea. He's distilling for us the notions that are put forth in the Gemara and Brachot. But these Gemarot, the passages in the Talmud, that serve as the basis for the Rambam's notions, these drashot, these rabbinic deductions of laws from biblical texts, provide a full-fledged proof that the principles of prayer are derived from the Torah, rather than the Torah verses constituting a mere prop or support. The halachic outlook necessitates this approach, for the halacha could not overlook an apparently irresolvable problem and paradox. Relating to God through speech and supplication appears to our sages as a brazen and adventurous activity. How can mortal man, who is today here and tomorrow in the grave, approach the Supreme King, the Holy One, blessed be He? Does an ordinary subject have license to speak to a great and exalted King and petition Him for his needs? So the whole premise of prayer, that we can address God, where does that come from? How do we know that? Of course, the experience of we, simple subjects, addressing the great King is one of fear and trembling, which is an integral part of the religious life. Yirat Shamayim, Peter, this was our conversation by email back and forth during the week. Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, awe of heaven, living in a world in which we have a kind of consciousness of the divine, that we are judged for our actions, we are called to task, we live in a world of hashkacha pratit, of providence, where God is involved in our lives, but in which we're also responsible for our actions, is meant to generate a certain fear of heaven. Not fear in a kind of Freudian, debilitating fear, not a kind of anxiety, paralyzing anxiety, but awe, reverence, an emotion which is kind of foreign, I think, to a lot of modern experience and sensibilities. The idea of reverence. We've lost a sense of reverence, of awesomeness, of majesty. I mean, maybe we who don't live in countries that have kings, and even people who live in countries that still have royalty, it's not the royalty of old, it's the royalty that does stupid things and get on the covers of tabloid magazines so that you don't have a lot of reverence for them. Peter asks, does not prayer in its banal sense evacuate the soul for Yirat Shamayim to take place? I'm not sure I understand what you're asking. Can you want to explain it on the microphone?
I'll try.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just thinking that most set prayer, obviously God knows what we want before we ask Him, in a sense, so we externalize something which in a sense is banal, we rehear it, we reanalyze it, pushes us back into a very human sense, but the inner sense that's happening while that's going on is unclouded by this confusion that's sort of going on outside. So prayer is a kind of manifestation of the vacuum within, which then produces this amazing filling up of the soul. Make some sort of sense?
I think so, if I understand what you mean. It's true that a lot of our prayers are banal. No, we have like daily needs and worries and concerns, and we had them yesterday, we have them today, we'll have them again tomorrow. Some of that may be motivated by like our need to, you know, have lunch yesterday and to have it again today and to have it again tomorrow. Isaac, I'll come to you in a second. But that notion of like making the space, you know, that's a notion that certainly exists in, you know, not even just the Kabbalistic literature, but any of the discussions of Kavanah, which we actually together discussed quite a bit in the previous weeks, in the previous session. So I think that does resonate. Yes, Isaac, go ahead. Yeah, Isaac, go ahead. Your microphone's open.
Touching on what you said about Esparta.
What's that? Isaac, I'm sorry that your microphone seems to be giving you some trouble. Feel free to post a comment in the chat. Yeah, so Dominic asks the notion of like the three steps forward, the three steps back at the beginning and the end of the Amidah is related to this idea of literally mimicking the physical entering of the divine presence. It's like we're leaving our space and we're transporting into a different space. The symbolism of this practice to take three steps back and three steps forward at the beginning, the end of the prayer is explained in different ways, but I think on the simplest level that's obviously what it is, to enter into an audience. Sorry, it appears my computer can't handle my being allowed to talk somehow. Okay, so Isaac, if you have a question, you can chat it in. The experience of fear and trembling, which is an integral part of religious life, complicates the problem of prayer and turns it into a riddle. Here's the paradox of prayer. On the one hand, it's impossible for man to come close to God. The more he approaches God, the more man negates his finite human status. Finitude is swallowed up by infinity and perishes in its labyrinth. Man at times flees from God and hides from him, lest he be engulfed, and Moses hid his face and he feared to look upon God. Man's selfhood and self-confidence are annulled by confrontation with the greatness of God and his majesty, meaning that the closer you get, the more difficult it is. If so, the question arises, how can prayer take place? Prayer is standing before God, in the presence of the Shekhinah, the divine presence. But how can man find himself in the presence of God without losing his individual existence? In other words, it's like, think of, the gravity of planetary bodies in space. The sun is so massively huge compared to the Earth, compared to any of the other planets, that we need to be so far away from the sun, so far away at Kvekach, that the sun and the moon appear to us to be equal in size when we look at them in the sky, but it's only an illusion. The sun is many, 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 many times, if I did my homework, I'd have the exact number. The sun is many, 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 multiple times larger than the moon. But the moon is very, very close to the Earth, and the sun is very far away, and therefore, up in the sky, they look to be the same. The sun needs to be, the Earth, rather, needs to be so far away from the sun, otherwise it would be, gravity would pull us right in. We wouldn't be able to exist. On the other hand, if we were too far away, we would be outside the little zone, the window of being able to have enough sunlight to produce the kind of energy and other things here on Earth that we need for life to exist. So if we were to be close, too close, we'd be sucked in. We wouldn't be able to survive. We would be a drop in the bucket. If the Earth were to crash into the sun, no one would even notice. So, Lahavdil, and I'm not comparing God to the sun for all the problematic reasons that the Rambam explains at the beginning of Hilchot Avodah Zarah, but the mashal should be obvious, the metaphor should be obvious, the parable should be obvious, that the notion that we can communicate with the king, with God, well, in order to communicate with him, we need to have a certain level of intimacy. And to whatever degree that level of intimacy would exist, that creates the paradox that, well, wouldn't we just be sucked right in? Wouldn't our insignificance overwhelm us? How can that conversation even take place? God, the awesome and terrifying sovereign, negates all being, annihilates all otherness, and turns all else into nothingness. When Moses pleaded with God to be shown his glory, he received the curt reply, "You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." Moses, at least according to Chazal's understanding, Moshe asks to be granted some kind of unique vision, that instead of being able to experience God from far, he wants to experience him up close. And God says it's not possible. And it's not that if you see me, you'll die. It's that because you are alive, in other words, read the pasuk not as "for no man can see me and live," but "no living man can see me," because by definition, the limitations of being a live human being means that you are limited in your ability to understand me, because God is so far and distant and removed and unique and set apart that it's lo machshavotai machshavotechem, that it's a completely separate type of existence. In the Rambam's felicitous phrase, it's like a fish trying to imagine life on dry land. Yeah, so that when the Torah says, this the Rambam describes explicitly, when it says that Moshe speaks to God as one speaks to his fellow, it's a metaphor. It means that Moshe's level of prophecy is in a unique category, but not that it was a kind of communication the way that, you know, you can communicate with, you know, with the, you know, the person at Starbucks. Okay. If this is the case, what is the character of prayer? Since we have this distance, so how can we pray? The whole substance of prayer is petition and supplication for man's petty needs, as we have indicated, is puzzling and beyond our ken. Can man attain a foothold within divine transcendence? Can he shower him with a plethora of insignificant matters? Halachic thought labored mightily to resolve this question, to discover a basis for the permitting flesh and blood to approach his creator. So halachic thought, again, I remind you, when the Rav uses the term halachic, he uses it in the way that other thinkers and writers might, you know, just say Judaism. But for Rabbi Soloveitchik, since the halachic corpus, principally the Talmud, but not exclusively, is the embodiment of Jewish thought, so he refers to the body of Jewish thought as halachic thought. So halachic thought, Jewish thought, Jewish philosophy, is puzzled by this. And it tries to figure out the answer to this question. How can measly little us approach the divine King of Kings? Why in the world should he, with a capital H, be interested in our petty little desires and requests? So therefore we seek a basis for permitting it, for what in Hebrew he calls a matir. What allows us, what gives us the audacity to pray? This permission is based on three fundamental ideas of Judaism. And these permissions, the permission to pray, these the three notions of how it's how prayer itself even gets out the gate. This we'll turn our attention to next week. But if you're interested, you might want to look ahead, besides looking at the essay, but to look at the famous Gemara in Brachot. I will link to it on the page. I'll also link to it in English. The Gemara in Brachot on Daf Kavavam Beis, 26b, on what is the source of prayer. Does prayer correspond to the temple sacrificial service, or does prayer somehow correspond to the precedent set by the Avot, by Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Abraham, Jacob, and David, who themselves prayed? So is prayer a kind of substitute for the sacrificial service, which we no longer have, to stand in, the placeholder, or is it something that is independent of that and corresponds to the intimate relationship that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had with God that we continue, although in a more formalized way? So we will pick up on that when we continue next week.